Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Enrico Fermi is considered one of the brightest scientific minds of the 20th century. His advances in physics led to the creation of nuclear energy and the development of the atomic bomb. But Fermi isn't as widely known to the general public as some of his contemporaries. Physicist Robert Oppenheimer, often referred to as the father of the atomic bomb, described Fermi's role after his death in 1954.
His impact during his lifetime, very great, in the professional community, among physicists, he was deeply loved, imitated, as far as it lay in people's power to do so.
David Schwartz wrote about Fermi and his accomplishments in a new book entitled The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. David Schwartz joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
What a wonderful thing to say about someone, imitated as far as it lay in people's power to do so.
It's really wonderful. I hadn't heard that quote before. But there's a great story about Oppenheimer and that particularly, which is after the war, after Fermi's death, Oppenheimer was at a cocktail party and apparently suggested a game where people would pretend to be someone else. They'd say, okay, I'm going to be so-and-so. Ask me questions. And it was supposed to be sort of amateur psychology. And people went around the room and did this. And then when it came time for Oppenheimer, Oppenheimer said, I'm now Enrico Fermi. And people were sort of stunned because they didn't realize that, how deeply embedded Fermi was in Oppenheimer's sort of worldview. But it was an interesting moment for people at that party.
Why don't we hear more about Enrico Fermi?
Well, he was personally quite reticent about his personal life. He wasn't very much of a media personality. He shied away from the media and liked to keep his physics private. So I think that in many respects he was very different from your media stars today, the scientists who like to be on TV and like to spread the word through public media. He had a very private way of doing things. He loved performing in the classroom and loved lecturing, loved being around physicists, but he was not a public person and kept very private that way. And I think that's one of the main reasons why he's not so well known today.
And you also mentioned at least a few times in the book that his papers were about physics. He didn't have he didn't write a lot of letters. He didn't write diaries. He didn't keep track of his personal life in a way that was useful to you, at least, right?
Well, he didn't write anything down of a deeply personal nature. He very rarely wrote personal. Well, I have not seen any personal letters of his, and I've been through the archives both in Pisa and in Chicago. He didn't publish any non-physics essays about his thoughts on the world, his thoughts about the atomic bomb, his thoughts about his role in the making of it. So he's really quite personally, quite reticent, a very private man, which is an odd combination given his gregariousness. He was a very gregarious person and
right,
enjoyable to be around, but he just was very closed about himself and his own personal thoughts.
The title of the book, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, you don't make any secret about what you're referring to there. It wasn't like he was a Renaissance man. It was the last man who knew everything about physics. Give us a thumbnail about how great Fermi was and how revered he was in the physics community in his age.
Well, he contributed to every area of physics. There are probably more things named after him in the field of physics than there are anyone else. I mean, I think there are 30 or 40 either constants or concepts that are named after him, the most famous one being fermions, which are named after him. A fermion is basically all particles that obey a certain quantum physics rule of what's called the exclusion principle. It's basically what allows matter to be sort of solid and not fall in on itself. Everyone in the physics community talks about fermions, and it's a tribute to Fermi. When he died, and this is really extraordinary, when he died, a group of his colleagues at Argonne Lab put together a two-disc record called To Fare Me With Love, which was a series of reminiscences, very affectionate, about Fermi and these people's interactions with him. You don't find that with other physicists. You just don't. It's really quite extraordinary. He created the area of the weak interaction, which is neutrino physics, through his theory of beta decay. Physicists have won dozens and dozens of Nobel Prizes exploring that particular part of physics. And he's really tremendously influential.
He was a great teacher, as you said. He loved the art of the classroom, the art of teaching. He started doing that when he was a teenager, because, of course, he was a prodigy, and he started teaching as soon as he would learn.
I think the teaching was very much a part of the way he learned, and he never felt that he really understood something unless he, unless he had explained it to someone else. So when he was a teenager, he would explain things to his good friend Enrico Persico, and he continued to do that throughout his life. And when he was dealing with a problem, when he was trying to figure out the solution to a complicated problem like quantum electrodynamics or the theory of beta decay, he would do that in a group setting where he would think aloud and bounce ideas off of people, and there would be an interaction, and he would effectively be teaching people through his thought process.
He also was well known for the fact that he had a penchant for theory as well as experimentation.
Yes, and that's very unusual, because theorists tend to be people who really like to sit and scribble on paper all day long, or, you know, on blackboards, and they live very much in their heads. Experimentalists love equipment, love setting up experiments, love the empirical aspect of their work. And many of them just love the electronics, too. They're sort of frustrated electronics. My father was one of those guys.
He, a Nobel laureate himself, by the way.
And he built our color TV out of a Heathkit many years ago. For those of you in the audience who remember Heathkit.
I sure do.
But experimentalists and theorists generally tend to be very different kinds of people. But for Fermi, it was all the same. You know, when he got bored doing theory, he would go to experiments. When he got bored with experiments, he'd go to theory. And he was equally adept at both throughout his whole life. And it's one of the great mysteries why that was. But you have a guy who really didn't make much of a distinction between theory and experiment. And one of the important parts of that is that all of his theory was based very, very concretely on empirical observations. He always felt that the further a theory gets from empirical observation, the less valuable it is. So that was reflected in his love of experiment as well as theory.
Then, of course, correct me if I'm wrong on any technical references in this conversation.
I'm sure you won't be. You'll be fine.
But he discovered, or was part of the team that discovered, the nuclear chain reaction. And it kind of felt for me like a metaphor of how he went about his work. He wasn't satisfied just discovering something. Then he wanted to know everything about what he discovered and all the ins and outs of it. He wasn't content to just move on to another question.
Yes, he did that several times in his career. First with his discovery that if you slowed neutrons down, these neutral heavy particles that exist in the nucleus of every atom, or most atoms, if you take neutrons and you bombard elements with those neutrons, sometimes those elements become radioactive. And if you slow the neutron down, making it pass through something like water or graphite, they become even more radioactive. And he discovered that, and he explored that from 1934, when the first discovery was made, through 1938, every day, all day long, he just ground it out. And then when he discovered the chain reaction in 1942 at the University of Chicago, he spent the next few years just doing more and more work on chain reactions and how they work and what are the circumstances that speed them up or slow them down, how they operate. So he was someone who was not content with he wasn't content with being a hunter. There's sort of a distinction that some people make between the hunters and the farmers. in science. And hunters are the people who discover things, and the farmers are the ones who develop the discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And he was both. He didn't see a distinction between the two, and he loved doing both.
As I mentioned, he was a prodigy. He was at a very young age. They figured out something was up with this guy. Who helped him nurture those gifts, though? Because, you know, you think of all the people that have gone by without somebody there to shepherd them.
Yeah, man, that's really a tragedy. When you see, when you compare your observation to Fermi's early life, you see how important it is to have a mentor. He had two mentors who were really quite special to him. One was a friend of his father's who was an engineer and who discovered that Fermi was interested in science. And when he probed a little bit, he discovered that Fermi had an unbelievable aptitude for both mathematics and physics, and really prepared an undergraduate physics curriculum for him from the ages of 13 to 18. By the time Fermi arrived at university, there was nothing that anyone at university could teach him about physics. It was such a thorough grounding that this fellow named Adolfo Amide gave Fermi. So that was he was the first mentor, and really Fermi's huge foundational knowledge of physics, which enabled him to be as great as he was established during that period. The second mentor that he had was also a very, very important guy named Mario Orso Corbino. And Corbino was the head of the physics department at the University of Rome. He was also a very prominent public figure, a senator in the Italian Senate. And while he was never a fascist, he was opposed to fascism, he also served in Mussolini's government. And Corbino saw in Fermi an opportunity to put Italy on the map with respect to physics. Italy was considered a backwater of physics in the early 20th century. Corbino saw Fermi, saw what he was capable of doing, and said, I'm going to make this guy my guy for putting Italian physics on the world map. And he finagled a position for him as the head of senior professor of theoretical physics at the University of Rome. I think he was 26 or 27 when he got that job, and really promoted Fermi in a lot of different ways and enabled Fermi to shine and to really develop a school of physics in Rome that was world class.
But it was all about physics with him. I never got the sense that he was ambitious, and I put quotation marks around that, that he was doing it, like, as you mentioned, he wasn't in it for the press and for the adulation.
That's correct. I mean, I think he occasionally would grouch in later years,
yeah,
about the kind of adulation that Einstein got.
Right.
But generally, he was not interested in that at all, and he certainly wasn't interested in fame and fortune. You know, he was interested in his finances and was always trying to find ways to make a little bit more money, but he would never have gone into business. He just loved physics and enjoyed physics all the time. It was very, in some ways, you could consider him very one-dimensional, but I try in the book to round out his personality because
yeah,
he had a very, very vibrant personality, which was apparent to everyone who interacted with him. And he also was an interesting guy when he wasn't thinking about physics. He was always outdoors and doing a lot of physical activity with groups of people. He loved being around people and would always invite people for walks or hikes or mountain climbing or expeditions, and loved doing that on the weekends.
I love the cover of the book.
That's a special photograph. When I saw the photograph for the first time, it's in a book by one of his colleagues named Leona Libby, and the book's called Uranium People. And this is a picture that she took on the beach at Lake Michigan, just east of the University of Chicago campus. And he's racing on the beach there. I thought that was such a typical Fermi picture, because it captures not only his love of the outdoors and his love of physical activity, but his competitiveness as well.
He's in the front.
he wants to be out in front, and he is out in front.
Yes. And people are following him.
Yes.
My guest is David Schwartz. He is the author of a new biography of Enrico Fermi. The book is entitled The Last Man Who Knew Everything. If you have a question or comment out there about Enrico Fermi, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the life and legacy of physicist Enrico Fermi. 1938 was a pivotal year for Fermi and his family. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, but the rise of the fascist government in Italy threatened. In a 1970 documentary, Fermi's wife, Laura, described why they left their homeland.
A set of laws were passed in the summer that affected the Jews, but also that affected other people. They would have made the living in that country and raising our children in that country so bad that we decided to emigrate.
Still with us, author David Schwartz. His new book is entitled The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. That was a big deal. He traveled to the United States. He loved the United States. He loved the wide open spaces and the energy of the United States. But Laura Fermi was not as enthusiastic about it. So that was a big deal that they moved.
Yes, it was a very big deal. Fermi had been trying to get Laura to move to the United States with him since the early 30s. And there were a number of reasons. He loved American culture, but he also loved the fact that America was a wealthier country and could devote more resources to physics, and that was very apparent to him. And I think that he was getting very, very anxious about sort of losing his spot at the cutting edge of world physics if he were to stay in Italy. And then in the summer of 1938, as Laura says in that documentary, the Italian government, under pressure from Nazi Germany, began to pass anti-Semitic laws that really restricted the ability of Italian Jews to be full citizens. Now, what's very interesting about that, and what many people don't know, is that in addition to passing that law, Mussolini also gave Italian Jews an opt-out clause. In other words, if you were a very prominent, wealthy, and important, politically important Italian Jewish family, you could apply for exemption from the laws. And in January 1939, Laura's father, who was an admiral in the Italian Navy, applied for exemption for the whole family and received it. Now, it's not clear that Laura knew this, and it's not at all clear that mm-hmm. she would have come back anyway. But she was finally persuaded in the summer, fall of 1938 to leave Italy, and they had to make plans to escape because he was under surveillance from the political police in Italy, as a very high-profile scientist. They didn't want to lose him, and so he had to be somewhat surreptitious about his departure. He left via Stockholm, where he picked up the Nobel Prize, and then went through England to the United States.
In fact, it was a rare occurrence that the Nobel Committee contacted him a couple years before that to say.
No, it was that fall.
Okay.
That fall. And what happened was he was at a cocktail party in Copenhagen. He was in Copenhagen for a conference, and at this cocktail party, Niels Bohr grabs him and pulls him aside and says, "If you were to be awarded the Nobel Prize, would you be allowed to go to Stockholm to accept it?" And the reason Bohr asked that is that the Germans had prohibited German scientists from accepting Nobel Prizes as a result of a political scandal in 1936. Fermi knew Mussolini well enough to know that he would be allowed to accept the Nobel Prize. And so he assured Bohr that he would be allowed to accept. And so he's probably the only person in the history of the prize who had foreknowledge that he was going to win. The only question in his mind was whether he would win alongside someone else or whether he would win on his own. And as it turned out, he won on his own.
When he accepted the prize, he did not perform the fascist salute. That became a thing among the Italian press.
Yes, it certainly did. Well, he had no intention
exactly
of doing the fascist salute. He probably couldn't have cared less what the Italian press was saying about him at that particular point. Yes, but the Italian press decided that not only did he not give the fascist salute, he actually shook the king's hand.
Right.
And that was considered in fascist Italy to be fairly effeminate and to be looked down upon for all sorts of bizarre reasons that I don't really understand. And so they dwelt on that and were highly critical of him.
But they did sort of make this escape, and when I was reading about it, it seemed a little scary, and they could have been stopped at many spots along the way.
Well, they could have, and one of the things that they did to try to avoid all that was to travel with very little luggage. They had their two kids with them. They had a maid who came along with them to help out with the kids. But they traveled with very little luggage, and they got visas to pass through Germany. And here's something that was discovered by some Italian scholars not that long ago. Laura Fermi, who was born Jewish, converted to Catholicism and had a Catholic wedding, very private Catholic wedding to Enrico in the weeks before they left Italy. And that was so that she could have a passport that wasn't stamped as Jewish, because the new anti-Semitic laws would have required her to have her passport stamped as Jewish. And to travel through Germany with a passport like that would have been problematic. So she was able to do that. She never discussed this in either her book or her interviews subsequent to Enrico's death. But there are records, and it's pretty clear that that's exactly what happened.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the life and times of Enrico Fermi. He is called the father of the nuclear age, and my guest is the author of the latest biography of Fermi. It's entitled The Last Man Who Knew Everything, David Schwartz. Let's talk about Laura Fermi for a second. She was highly intelligent, was a very successful woman in her life for all sorts of reasons.
Yes. She was a very bright person. She was very interested in science. She had been taking science courses at the University of Rome before she met Enrico Fermi. She had been taking courses, in fact, with Fermi's good friend Enrico Persico. And she attended a salon that her father was invited to with a group of Italian mathematicians, which is where she met Enrico Fermi. She was very bright, she was very interested in science, and she was a fine writer. And she loved writing. She helped Enrico write the textbook on physics that was used by Italian high school students throughout the country and is still being updated today by the son of one of Fermi's very close collaborators. The collaborator was Eduardo Amaldi, and his son Ugo. Ugo continues to revise this textbook, but it was Laura who helped Enrico write that. She loved writing so much that after they finished that, she went on to write a book about the discovery of radioactivity with Eduardo Amaldi's wife, Ginestra, mm-hmm. who became a very good friend of hers, and that book did very well. And when she came to the United States, she wrote in English, Adams and the Family, which is a memoir of her marriage to Enrico, and a number of other books, one about Mussolini, one about immigrants to the United States. She was a very accomplished lady and very, very bright. And as much as anyone could be an equal partner in this marriage.
What was their marriage like?
Well, I think that it was a good marriage, but it had its moments. I think that he loved teasing her when they were courting about how little she knew about physics, and that must have irritated her to no end. I mean, she makes no bones about that in her memoir. She also was in the dark about much of what he was doing during the Manhattan Project. He took the strictures of secrecy quite seriously during the Manhattan Project. And the first time she knew what he was up to was after the war, when she read the book by Smythe, which was published, an official publication of the U.S. government, about the Manhattan Project. And that's when she learned, along with everyone else, what her husband had been doing for the last few years. In fact, the day that he created the first sustained controlled nuclear chain reaction at the University of Chicago, that evening, she was hosting a dinner party for a group of scientists at the lab, and people came over and congratulated Enrico for what he had done, but they just said congratulations. No one was mentioning what had actually been done. And she was quite mystified. She didn't know what had been done until after the war. So it took a certain kind of patience, I think, to deal with that kind of a person. But I think they deeply loved each other and respected each other.
Well, I was going to just say, by the way, her father who was an admiral, as you mentioned, right, in the...
Italian Navy.
Italian Navy. He ended up being sent to a concentration camp and died there.
Yes, I mean, that was very tragic. He believed that his status as a supporter of the regime and as an admiral in the Italian Navy protected him from any kind of persecution. And in fact, as I said, he was exempted in early 1939 from the Italian anti-Semitic laws. But in 1943, Mussolini fell, and the Germans took direct control over the government in Rome and rounded up Jews and sent them off to concentration camps. And he was sent off to Auschwitz and died there.
Enrico Fermi was not a classically well-educated man. And I often wonder if that played a role in his, he didn't keep a diary. He didn't think introspectively or didn't appear to think introspectively. He wasn't trained to. He thought pretty completely about physics. And he was also a man of incredible habit. And I couldn't help but think about the seven traits of highly successful people kind of thing, right? I also thought that would kind of drive me up a wall. He was super strict. He got up at 5:30 every morning. He had a very strict regimen to his day.
Yes, he did. He was a very orderly thinker and a very orderly person, and really was highly structured in the way he lived his life. There were moments when the occasion might have called for skipping lunch, but it was lunchtime, so he said, "It's time for lunch now." Uh-huh. And one of those was during the day when they discovered that neutrons, when slowed down, made elements even more radioactive. The other was in the middle of that day when he created the first nuclear chain reaction. There was a moment when the instrumentation shut the reactor down. Instrumentation had been set at a level that was too low for there to get a sustained reaction, so they just shut the reactor down. And after they figured out what had happened, he said, "Okay, it's time for lunch." And they all went to lunch because it was time for lunch, and he was going to have his lunch. And he was that kind of guy. He was very – it's interesting you say he wasn't classically – he wasn't educated the way we think of in America.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone was really in those days.
Probably, yeah.
He was as close to trained as anyone was, because the school that he went to – in Pisa. He went to the University of Pisa, but he also went to the Scuola Normale Superiore, and was required to take a broader range of courses. But I really think that temperamentally, he was not a particularly introspective person, had little interest in philosophy, and was deeply, deeply driven by physics for reasons that remain mysterious, because he didn't write about it. But it's clear that from the time he was 12 or 13, this is all he wanted to do.
He could have been a great mathematician, as you mentioned earlier.
I think so. Um, he He was a good enough mathematician to hold his own against someone like John von Neumann, but at the same time, he understood his limitations
okay.
in mathematics. He once came back from a session with von Neumann at Los Alamos and was regaling his colleagues in Chicago around lunch table, and he said that he felt a little like a fly who's, well, standing next to von Neumann and watching von Neumann do calculations, he felt a little bit like a fly who's sitting on a plow and who exclaims, "Wow, I'm plowing." And, you know, the fly has absolutely no effect on the plow at all. And he felt that way when he was watching von Neumann, because von Neumann was just so much better than he was in mathematics. But he could hold his own, and he was, you know, deeply comfortable with mathematics, and in fact was probably more of a mathematical physicist than many of his peers.
You wrote that his distance, both psychologically and physically, from the travails of the First World War is notable. And I was wondering about World War II and helping build the bomb, and that he, you know, if that didn't, since he wasn't involved in World War I, escape that kind of horror, that he didn't think as much. I mean, did his introspection reach to the building of the bomb?
Well,
or his lack of introspection?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think it did. I think that he understood the magnitude of what he was engaged in. I think early on in the project, he was a reluctant participant, and you can see that in a number of ways. When he was asked by the Navy, well, he was briefing the Navy about the possibility of nuclear weapons in March of 1939, and he downplayed the possibility, thought that it was not likely that those weapons could be made. And I think that reflected a reluctance on his part to go down that road. In the summer of 1939, he had an encounter with the great German physicist Werner Heisenberg and tried to persuade Heisenberg to emigrate to the United States, as he had done. Heisenberg said that he wasn't interested in doing that and would go back to Germany. Fermi understood that meant that Heisenberg would be involved in the German version of the Manhattan Project and became much more committed to the project after that point. Then later on, when Fermi came to Los Alamos in the summer of 1944, Fermi participated, obviously, in the project. He didn't design the bomb or build the bomb in any sense, but he participated in a lot of the work underlying the bomb. But you could see occasionally his reluctance well up again, particularly when it came time to design what they called the trigger device, which was the device that would release neutrons at just the right moment to initiate the chain reaction that would blow up the bomb. And he kept on coming up with ideas that he said wouldn't work. And it was almost as if he was struggling to demonstrate that the bomb was not possible. And even on the day of the Trinity explosion, which was the first test explosion, he quipped to his colleagues that, well, if it doesn't work, at least we know that it isn't possible. And that would have been a great relief to him. So I think he understood very much what he was doing. And, you know, even though he understood what he thought was the necessity of doing it, which was that the Germans might get it first, he was not happy about having to do that.
We are talking about physicist Enrico Fermi. He's known as the father of the nuclear age. My guest is David Schwartz. His new book is entitled The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the life and legacy of groundbreaking physicist Enrico Fermi. America's Particle Physics and Accelerator Laboratory, Fermi Lab, bears his name, as does a nuclear power plant in Michigan. An element on the periodic table, fermium, is also named for the Nobel laureate. Though his contributions to physics were great, his legacy is not as well known as some of his contemporaries. Still with us is author and Fermi biographer David Schwartz. His new book is entitled The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. What kind of father was Enrico Fermi to his children?
I think he was not a very good father. He was somewhat indifferent. I mean, he didn't abuse them in any sense, but I think he neglected them. Certainly, they felt neglected. He was a person who was driven by his career, and like many people, many fathers in the 40s and 50s, spent a lot of time at work and very little time with his kids. And when he spent time with his kids, I think he was somewhat perfunctory in terms of his ability to be a father. Certainly his son felt that way and was fairly miserable. Tried to, in fact, distance himself considerably from his father in his later years. His daughter, Nella, was a happier person and I think had fonder memories of her father, but still felt that he was very distant to them, to her and to her brother.
Now, his son was a pretty gifted mathematician.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was a brilliant mathematician and went to Princeton where he got his PhD and did some work for the Defense Department for a number of years before going to work in Cambridge University for the Nobel Prize winner Max Perutz, who was modeling complicated proteins. And Giulio, who became Judd in high school,
yeah.
He tried to de-Italianize himself. Judd worked on mathematical models of representing complicated protein molecules, and was a brilliant, brilliant guy. Quiet and did not like the limelight, and lived a very quiet quiet life with his wife, Sarah, who is still alive and is a lovely person living in Cambridge still.
I thought it was interesting that the grandchildren, that Enrico Fermi's grandchildren have sort of taken up the, you know, his legacy.
Yeah, the two of the grandchildren are particularly active in this. One, Olivia Fermi, who lives in Vancouver, has two blogs that are devoted to matters related to her father. One is the Fermi Effect, which is about her family, and the other is the Neutron Path, I think it is, which is about her exploration of the nuclear legacy of her grandfather. The other is Rachel Fermi, who is a fine photographer in her own right, and worked with a woman named Esther Samra to put together a really, really comprehensive photographic archival book of the Manhattan Project. It's called Picturing the Bomb. And that's a book that is essential for anyone who is interested in the Manhattan Project and the history behind it. It's a great book to have, and it's still available. So both of those grandchildren have actively engaged their grandfather's legacy.
Dennis in Zanesville, you're on the air with author David Schwartz. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hi, Dennis.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Okay, I just had like a quick question. If you took like the pantheon of physicists, Niels Bohr, Enrico Fermi, Albert Einstein, Edward Teller, and anyone else you would want to add, if you tried like to list those, I know that I've heard that without Albert Einstein, you can't ever have nuclear weapons. But I know that wasn't his intent with the theory of relativity. In the development of the weapons, the nuclear weapons, who's like the most important? Is Einstein because of the theory of relativity?
Oh, it's really hard to say. It's a great question, though. It's a great question. It's hard to really say. I would say there are people who believe that if Fermi had decided not to work on the Manhattan Project, that it wouldn't have happened because he knew more about how neutrons interact with matter than anyone in the world at that particular moment. and could conduct the experiments that were essential in doing that. Now, you know, I don't know whether that's true or not. I think that there were a lot of people, you know, certainly Oppenheimer was, if anything, even more essential, not from the scientific point of view necessarily, but from the organizational point of view. He was the only person who could really hold this group of very independently minded scientists together. There were other scientists like Hans Bethe, who ran the theory department at the Manhattan Project, who a brilliant, brilliant scientist and a colleague of Fermi's, who was essential. Richard Feynman was a young man in the project, very, very important. Emilio Segre, another Fermi colleague from the days in Rome, was an essential person in terms of understanding how plutonium worked. So there are a lot of people. It's really hard to say who is the single most important person. But I was having a conversation recently with the biographer of Leo Szilard, who is another one of these wonderful, brilliant scientists who participated in the project and was actually the person who first thought about chain reactions. And this biographer, Bill Lanouette, said to me that he thought if Fermi had arrived in Ann Arbor and had not met Szilard when Szilard was hanging out at Columbia in January 39, not only would we not have had the chain reaction, we might not well have had the bomb itself. So there are people who believe that. It's a great question and one of the great imponderables.
Thank you, Dennis, for that call. Enrico Fermi is known for his opinion about extraterrestrial life. It's known as the Fermi paradox, and you called it a back-of-the-envelope observation. Tell us about that.
Well, I think I'm not sure he was deeply interested in the subject.
Exactly,
but I think that he was. He made an observation. People were having a lunchtime discussion about the possibility of traveling at speeds approaching the speed of light that would enable interstellar travel, and. He grew quiet for a little while, and then he blurted out, "Where are they all?" And everyone understood him to mean that he had done the calculation, which suggested that, you know, if life appears on, you know, sort of 0.1% of all the planets that circulate stars in the universe, and, you know, travel at or near the speed of light is possible, then we would by now have been visited by lots and lots of intelligent beings, and we haven't been, so where are they all? And it was just a, you know, sort of a typical back-of-the-envelope calculation that Fermi made without any kind of accuracy or scientific basis behind it. It was just making a series of assumptions about how large the universe is, how long intelligent life might be willing to travel in space in order to find other life, and how old the universe is. I mean, all of which, by the way, was information that turned out not to be correct in those days, because, you know, we now know that the universe is much, much larger than it was thought at the time and much older than it was thought at the time. But that was his observation. I mean, the person who really did the work on this was a fellow named Drake, and the Drake equation does a much more precise estimate of you know, the possibility of life on other planets. But it is based in some part on the kind of thinking that Fermi had.
I was wondering why this book, now obviously you didn't just start writing it last week, but why you picked up this topic now, why Enrico Fermi?
When I first became I was always aware of Enrico Fermi because my father was a particle physicist who had done work in neutrino physics. So I was always aware of him. But I didn't really know very much about him until 2013 when I was reading some papers that came from my father's files. My father had passed away in 06, and my mom sent me his files. And I read this 20-page paper about Enrico Fermi's time in Chicago and thought, what an interesting guy. I had no idea that he was such a great teacher, and I had no idea that he was great at theory as well as experiment, and he sounds like an interesting guy. I'll go out and find a biography of him. And I looked, and I found that the last biography of him at that point was written in 1970 by Emilio Segre. I thought, wow, that doesn't seem right. You know, there's a biography of Einstein every other year. There's a biography of Oppenheimer, you know, twice in a decade. You know, people know all about Stephen Hawking. And I'm not to denigrate any of them. They're all great, you know, fabulous people, fabulous minds. But Fermi was relatively less known. And I thought, I'd like to remedy that. And that's why I decided to do it when I did it.
He dies of stomach cancer at a relatively young age, and there is speculation about his work with radioactivity and his cancer. Can you talk about what happened to him in the end?
Well, in the end, he was on a at a conference in Lake Como in fall of 1954, and began to have a lot of trouble swallowing and keeping food down, and had very, very bad stomach pains. When he got back to Chicago in September, October of 1954, he went to the hospital, and they did a little procedure, an exploratory procedure, and found that he had cancer that had metastasized from his stomach all over the place, and so they decided not to operate. And he died 6 weeks later. It was very aggressive and very advanced. Whether it was caused by his involvement with radioactive substances is one of the great mysteries. You know, a number of people were with him during the experiments in Rome when he was dealing with highly radioactive substances, mm-hmm. and they didn't suffer from the same illness. That, then again, you know, Fermi was probably much more directly involved than any of his teammates in handling the radioactive substances and running them up and down the corridor so that they can be measured by the Geiger counters that were in another room. So that's one possible explanation. You know, it's very hard to say. There's, you know, the medical records are just not clear about where the cancer came from. But it is certainly possible that he suffered as a result of his exposure to radioactive elements.
How old was he when he died?
53.
Wow,
young man, and young man, and to have accomplished so much in such a short time is really astonishing.
It is. You wrote an essay about what he would think about the scientific landscape today. How do you think he'd view the progress that's been made?
Oh, I think he'd be just delighted. I think we're in a golden age in so many different areas of physics that he would just be astonished and pleased. I don't think that he ever imagined that we could have particle accelerators as powerful as the one in Geneva. I mean, he joked about building a particle accelerator that was sort of encircled the Earth, the globe, out in outer space. And that particle accelerator that he joked about is just about as powerful as the one in Geneva. He didn't imagine that you could build something quite so powerful, and he would be amazed at what's been discovered there. He'd also be amazed at the recent discoveries of gravity waves and, you know, the observations of neutron stars merging together and creating these cataclysmic events. He'd be fascinated by what's going on in biology and genetics. There's just a whole range of things that would have fascinated him. And, you know, I think many of the things that we see today, particularly in physics, are the culmination of agendas that he really began to explore in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
But, you know, back in the day, he was kind of a superstar. He was among superstars. Nowadays, scientists, well, they're disregarded in some cases, in many cases.
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know whether they're disregarded, but certainly it's much harder for an individual scientist to make an impact. And that probably would have displeased him. You know, the experiments at CERN in Geneva involved thousands and thousands of physicists on every experiment. You know, his experiments in Rome had five or six people. His experiments, you know, at the Manhattan Project, I think there were 40 people or 45 people in the Chicago pile experiment. The Manhattan Project itself at Los Alamos, I think there were 300, 400 physicists. Mm-hmm. Now, the Manhattan Project had many hundreds of thousands of people. But, you know, in Los Alamos, there were only a couple hundred physicists who were working on the project. So the growth of big science would not have appealed to him, I think. But I think he would have understood the necessity for it.
David Swartz, thank you so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed it.
Well, I really enjoyed it, too. Thank you so much for having me on.
David Swartz, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. Thank you for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.